Well, we've reached the final class session for this 2 weeks meeting, and the 2 weeks have gone fast. It's my intention today to talk about the New Testament, a subject I would have hoped to have opened up beginning yesterday, but as things worked out, that wasn't possible. And I'm thankful for Doug stepping in my stead. I really appreciate that a lot. Today we're going to be talking primarily about the New Testament manuscripts, and then probably open that up into a discussion about the Textus Receptus and the idea of the critical translations of the New Testament. In your hand, if it's reached your hand, you're going to have a two-sided handout. We probably won't get to the second side today, in all honesty. Good question. Which is the first side? Well, the one with all the tables on it, the multiple tables, that's the first side. Thank you, Keith. That will be what we cover today. You're all supposed to read my mind. Okay. Yeah. No, it's a short read, not very interesting, that's for sure. I once said it. All right. Okay, at the top of the sheet, I provided a quotation from Ravi Zacharias from his book, Can Man Live Without God? And I think this is a great way of framing our consideration this afternoon so far as manuscript evidence is concerned. In this book, he states, in real terms, the New Testament is easily the best attested ancient writing in terms of, number one, the sheer number of documents, number two, the time span between events and the document, and three, the variety of documents available to sustain or contradict it. There is nothing in ancient manuscript evidence to match such textual availability and integrity. We're going to take each one of these by themselves and consider why Mr. Zacharias has arrived at this conclusion, and we'll begin with number one, the sheer number of documents. The New Testament is the best attested ancient writing in sheer number of documents available. F.E. Peters, a textual critic, asserts, on the basis of manuscript tradition alone, the works that make up the Christian's New Testament were the most frequently copied and widely circulated books of antiquity. And his quotation is precisely right as you look at the first table in the top left-hand corner. At present, there are 5,686 Greek manuscripts of the New Testament available. My number in this table is actually incorrect. That's from an older book, and that number has been updated since. 5,686, and it's possible that there's more now. We keep finding more of these as the years go by. 5,686 Greek manuscripts of the New Testament. Now, these are not all complete. Most of them, in fact, the overwhelming majority of them are just fragments. We only have a few complete manuscripts of the New Testament in the Greek language. In addition to those, there are 19,284 translations into other languages. So that gives us close to 26,000 manuscripts of the New Testament. We're talking about ancient manuscripts, those that are 1,000 to 1,500 years old. We'll just kind of put that number on it. 19,284 translations into other ancient languages. 19,284. When you compare this staggering number of manuscripts, the New Testament stands alone, and you can see this in your comparison chart. Homer's Iliad has 643 copies. That is the closest ancient document as far as the number of manuscripts go. I didn't just pick these out arbitrarily and try to pick a bunch that had small numbers. Homer's Iliad's the closest one. So it is, the New Testament dwarfs all other manuscript evidence. You'll notice Herodotus has 8 copies. Thucydides, the prince of Greek historians, his Peloponnesian War, has 8 copies. Plato, 7 copies. Demosthenes 200, Livy 19, Tacitus 20, Pliny Secundus 7. And I think this is a very important point, because when you go into a history class or an English class and these works are cited, they are cited with the understanding that what you're reading is what that person actually wrote. And that's just a given in most history or English classes. Yet that's not the same measuring stick that's used with the New Testament. And I think it's an unfair measuring stick, but we shouldn't expect anything but to be treated with partiality by the world. So you can see, just based on the number of copies alone, the Greek New Testament, and that is the Greek number down there, the 5366, which is actually 5686, separates itself off. That's not including the translations. Yes?
Just interesting question that it was overwhelmingly fragments of the...
You mentioned that the 5,686 copies of the New Testament are overwhelmingly fragmented.
Yes.
Is that true of the other works that are listed here as well?
I don't know. I didn't look into that. That's a good question. It's worth asking. Yeah. No, that's okay. I wish I knew. I just don't. So, anything else? Oh, thank you. Yes, that is noted there. That's 4th century partial, mostly 10th century. Yeah. It is. I put this table together 9 months ago, so it's possible that these are the complete manuscripts for each one of these, and I just noted that on Levy's. I just quite frankly don't remember. I'm sorry. So, yeah. Dwayne?
Wade, there's on the earliest copy of the New Testament, there's fragments that date to the second centuries.
Yes.
A fragment on the Book of John.
Yes.
And then there's some papyrus that are the Gospels and the letters of Paul that are collected, and they're on papyrus that are, I think, the year 200 to 250 or so.
Yes.
I don't remember the exact dates.
I think I've got those somewhere in my notes, but I'm not going to take the time to look. Yeah, we have partial. The earliest we have is that five verses in John that comes from the second century. I can't remember the exact dating. It's like 160, 170, 180, that neighborhood. I've heard various dates. It's interesting. Well, I won't go there. But yeah, I just won't say that. All right, anything else? Yes.
I just have a quick question on the 19,000 and some that are translated.
Mm-hmm.
Does that go with the year 325 AD also? Did those exist by that time?
No, the 325 AD represents, I believe, the Codex Sinaiticus, which is the first complete copy we have of the New Testament. That's the 325 date.
Okay, so by how old would you say these 19,000 and some translations are?
It's hard to say. I know that there are some Coptic translations that go back to the 4th century, but I'm not sure that we have anything before that. I just don't know off the top of my head. Yes. Yeah, we have. What would you say one more time?
All 19,000 are pretty early.
Yes, yeah. Well, it depends on how you define early. The overwhelming majority of the manuscript evidence we have comes from the 8th century onward. So we get before the 8th century and the numbers really begin to get narrower and narrower. So most of the stuff we have is from the 8th century and beyond. Before that, it gets more scarce. Good question. Yes, up here, Don's got a question.
I think what you need to note here is this is far before they had the printing press. So these were all handwritten copies, and that's what you were probably originally thinking makes it remarkable that there are so many.
Absolutely. That is the remarkable thing about it. And we didn't have time to get to this timeline, but on the back you'll notice I came up with a timeline as far as the manuscripts go. And, you know, this 225 years of persecution, roughly from the death of John, the Apostle John, to the Council of Nicaea in 325. We lost a lot of manuscripts in that time period. I'm just historians that are experts in this field are convinced that during this intense time of persecution, there were a lot of manuscripts burned. We lost a lot of that because all the samples that we have from that time period are fragments And there's just not a lot that came out of that. And it's most likely the same reason why we don't have a lot of the Jewish manuscripts before those Masoretic manuscripts came out. A lot of persecution, a lot of exile, possibility of these things being destroyed. So it is amazing when you consider all the factors working in here, the fact that they were writing these things out by hand, the fact that Christians were persecuted for the better part of 2.5 centuries. It's just quite frankly amazing that we have as much as we do. Yes, Gary?
I'm missing something here on this Homer. You got 400 B.C. for the New Testament?
Yes.
How can that be?
I'm sorry, what was that?
I'd say, how can that be that it was written before the New Testament happened? 400 B.C.
I'm so. Oh, no, go ahead and repeat your question one more time, Gary.
I thought all this was New Testament manuscripts.
The only New Testament manuscripts we have are down there on the bottom row there. That's all of our Greek New Testament manuscripts is that bottom row down there. All the Homer, Herodotus, Thucydides, Plato, Demosthenes, all those guys are Greek and Roman literary figures and historical figures that wrote other works. And the reason I bring this up is just to show that when we compare a set of sacred documents to a set of secular documents, God has provided an immense mountain of evidence in comparison. And these things are often accepted as the writers wrote them. And understanding is not given to the New Testament. Steve? Got Steve up here. Did that answer your question, Gary? Okay. Well, I'm sorry I didn't do better. I should have done a better job putting it together. Steve, go ahead. Neither did I.
You were just a moment ago speaking of during the persecutions, all the Christian document, you know, the manuscripts that were destroyed.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Now, many were destroyed, but many did survive.
Yes.
I mean, some did survive.
Yes.
Whereas these Greek documents during the Dark Ages were obliterated.
Yes.
And then later had to be during the Renaissance, they went to the Arabs.
Yes.
And had to retranslate from Arabic back into the other languages.
Yes.
Because there was nothing else to go from.
Fantastic point. A lot of people aren't aware of that, but all those classical authors from classical Greece and Rome, they were cast aside by the apostate church, and they were preserved by, of all people, the Islamic nations. And so these things came down to us from the Islamic nations. They're the ones that were the... Yeah. Yeah. It's interesting. I don't want to go down that road. But it's an interesting fact that the Islamic nations kept these things alive, so to speak. Anything else? All right. The second statement that Rabbi Zacharias makes there is that the New Testament is the best attested ancient document in terms of the time span between events and the document. And what I mean by that statement, or what he means by that statement, is the original document. From the time that these books were originally written to the time we have the first copy, there is an extremely small time gap in comparison to secular works. And that's what I've noted in that second to last column. Well, really beginning the third column on over, we'll just use Homer's Iliad as an example. Homer wrote his Iliad somewhere around 800 BC, if the tradition behind that's accurate. The earliest copy we have dates from around 400 BC. That's a time gap of 400 years. Herodotus' history was written somewhere between 480 and 425 BC. The earliest copy we have is from 900 AD. It's a time gap of 1,350 years. You can go down through the rest of the list on your own, but you'll notice when you get down to the bottom to the New Testament that the time gap between when the New Testament was originally written, when it was complete, and I'm using the year 100 as its completion point. And let's not get into when Revelation was written, please, okay? I'm just assuming that by 100, all the New Testament was written, and the Council of Nicaea, or excuse me, the Codex Sinaiticus, which dates from about 325, we have a time gap of 225 years, which is an astonishingly low number considering all the factors we've just discussed already. Precisely. Yeah, and the papyri serve essentially, I mean, we're talking about this, but so we have our first complete manuscript. It's 325 AD, and that's the Codex Sinaiticus. All right? And the New Testament's finished at 100 AD. And in between here, what we have is a bridge, essentially, of papyri fragments. Bridging the gap between when the New Testament was finished and when we had the first complete copy of it. And that's what both Dwayne and Kathy have pointed out, that it's not as if we have this period where there's nothing. We've got little bits and pieces until finally at 325 we've got this complete product, which is just a remarkable thing. Excuse me? The Codex Sinaiticus? Well, that's a story in and of itself. The Codex Sinaiticus, let me see, was in a monastery on Mount Sinai. And a man by the name of Tischendorf, back in the 19th century, set out to find as many Greek manuscripts of the New Testament as he possibly can. He had this idea that if he got as many as he could get a better idea of what the original text said. Well, he went to this monastery at Mount Sinai, and he was in, I can't remember if it was a library or just a room, and he noticed this pile of paper sitting over by the fire, and he could tell it was an ancient document. And the monks had been using this as kindling for their fire. And he went over and he grabbed it and said, "Can I have this?" And it was 47 leaves of the New Testament. And so he went back, I think, two more times. And eventually, almost the entire New Testament was gathered. And that became the Codex Sinaiticus, as we know it today. It's been estimated that dates back to about 325 AD. So, yeah, St. Catherine's Monastery. Yeah, exactly right. I couldn't remember the name of it off the top of my head, but yeah, that's it exactly. Yeah. Yeah, good question. Anything else? Yes, Dwayne?
I have seen it in the British Museum, and it is in remarkable condition.
Yes.
Some people said it's so old and worn out they were trashing it. Well, that's not the case.
I have seen in the manuscript in the British Museum, and it is in remarkable condition. And some people have said, well, it's old, they were trashing it, it was worthless, but that is not the case. It is a beautiful, well-done manuscript.
Yeah, Tom Woody has seen it as well. And the day he was there, it was open to Mark chapter 16, which if you're familiar with the debate of Mark 16, there's some question because the Codex Sinaiticus does not contain Mark 16, 9 through 20. Yeah. And Tom was able to see it. Now, this is interesting because you read this in books. You know, people who have seen the Codex Sinaiticus will tell you that there's this spot in Mark 16, 9 through 20, as if the scribe was just going to keep on writing it in there, but for whatever reason he didn't. And Tom has seen it. He said, "I saw it, and it just looks like the rest of the verses belong right there." Go ahead.
Yeah, and for those who are interested, you can go on the internet and you can see the various pages of this and how well it has been preserved.
Yeah. And I know I just opened up a can of worms there by saying that Mark 16, 9 through 20 is not in the Codex Sinaiticus, but bear with me. We'll get there, hopefully. Okay, Nancy Didion's got a hand back there.
Did you say when it was found in this monastery?
I don't know the exact date, but it was in the 19th century, second half of the 19th century, somewhere between 1850 and 1870. I'm thinking it was the 1860s, but I can't remember. He went back three times. So I can't remember the exact chronology on the dating, but his name is Tischendorf, and let me just write his name up here. Tischendorf. So he was extremely helpful in rescuing that from the flames. All right, anything else? Okay. So we have a very small time gap between the from the original writing to the most complete copy that we have. All right. The third thing Ravi Zacharias says is that the New Testament is the best attested ancient writing in terms of the variety of documents available to sustain or contradict it. And this is the second table down below. That's what this is all about. I think as we've made clear this week, and I think as you've already know, lost my pen. There we go. After the first century, prophecy died out, inspiration died out with whoever was the last person to die with having the apostles' hands laid upon them and given the miraculous gift of the Holy Spirit. So we know that inspiration died by somewhere mid-second century, and we know that with the end of the first century, that as far as written inspiration goes, that had ceased as well. But that doesn't mean that Christian writings ceased, because we have a group of authors in the second, third, and fourth centuries that continue to write on Christian subjects, and they quoted quite frequently from the New Testament. In the far left-hand column, you have, seven names. Of men who are called the Ante-Nicene Fathers. I do not like that title because Jesus said, call no man father. So I call them the Ante-Nicene Writers. We'll just put it that way. Now, these men were not inspired. Let me reemphasize that once again. And if you read their writings, they have some pretty wacky ideas about things. But what is helpful about their writings is that they quote very liberally from the New Testament. And this is a significant point. We don't have a lot of papyri fragments. We have some, but we have all these Ante-Nicene writers that help bridge the gap between the end of the first century and the Codex Sinaiticus in 325. And when we put those two things together, we can see that the New Testament was essentially not changing between here and here, although there are variations in the manuscript, and we may get into that a little bit later, it was essentially unchanged during this time period. Now, the rest of this table just gives you an idea of how much they quoted from the various parts of the New Testament. And I won't take the time to go through all those numbers, but in the bottom right-hand corner, you'll notice just above the citation where I got this material, you'll notice that they quoted from the New Testament, these seven men, 36,289 times. 36,289 times. And there's a lot more Ante-Nicene writers than just these. These are the major ones, so to speak. There's a lot more we could point to. There are so many quotations of the New Testament in their writings that if we lost all the copies, if all the manuscripts, if all the translations, ancient translations of the New Testament suddenly just disappeared one night off the face of the earth, we could take these men's writings and we could virtually reconstruct the entire New Testament just by using their quotations. In fact, one man by the name of Sir David Dalrymple posed this very question: what if we lost all the manuscripts? So he set about going through all the Ante-Nicene writers, and this is what he says. He writes, "As I possessed all the existing works of these writers from the second and third centuries, I commenced a search, and up to this time I have found the entire New Testament except 11 verses." Yeah. Now, I don't think he had gotten through the entire New Testament by that point, but that's still a significant thing. Even if he'd gotten through half of it and it was only missing 11 verses, that's a pretty remarkable statement about their content. Dalrymple. If that's not English, I don't know what is. That seems like an English name to me. Sounds like a Dickens character. Or Jane Austen, yes. Sir Dalrymple. All right. What's that? Is it really? Which book? Oh, okay. Really? Well, that's not an example of this. Jane Austen lived in the early 19th century, right? All right, anyways. Yeah. Yes, Wendy. The Nicene Creed, Council of Nicaea, 325. Same era. There are a lot of things that happened at that council. It's almost like 325 and 1546. Those two councils just really separate themselves out. 325, you've got that discussion about the nature of Jesus. You have the Catholic Church putting its stamp on the canon of the Bible at that moment. You have the Nicene Creed that comes out there. 1546 is when Luther debates the Catholic Church, and they add the Apocrypha into the canon, and all kinds of other things happen at there. So, yeah. Anything else? Yeah. Yes, Constantine was the one who convened the Council of Nicaea. Yeah. That's what he says, that his mother was a Christian. Yeah, we don't have any reason to doubt that. You know, and the question becomes, what does Christian mean at that point? Because Christianity, quote unquote, has changed dramatically by that point. By the time of the 4th century, the apostasy is well entrenched, and it's just a little hard to know for sure. So, anything else? Good questions. All right. Well, let's get into this Textus Receptus thing. Yes. Yes, the word ante means before. Yeah, so these are we would say pre Nicene writers, yeah, in our vernacular, that's the way we would put it. Ante-Nicene New Testament quotations, yeah, before the Council of Nicaea. Okay. All right, let's talk about the historical development of the Textus Receptus. As was mentioned on Wednesday, the Textus Receptus is the Greek manuscript which serves as the basis for both the King James and the New King James translations. In fact, I went home Wednesday night and just read through the opening pages of my New King James, and it talks about that very plainly, that it decided to keep that traditional text as its basis for the translation back in, what was that, 1982, I think, is when the New King James came out. All right. Gutenberg published an edition of the Latin Vulgate in the 1450s, 1456. But Greek texts were slow in production. At the beginning of the 16th century, there was a small race in Europe to see who could be the first person to publish a printed copy, printed off of a printing press, of a New Testament Greek manuscript. There was a man by the name of Erasmus. Who was one of the competitors in this race. And it was very much a race. It does appear that based on what we can read about this process, that accuracy was not really one of the concerns for the competitors. It was, let's see who can get this out first. Erasmus traveled to Basel, Switzerland, where there was a monastery, and he began the task of accumulating Greek manuscripts in order to come up with this Greek New Testament. Well, he couldn't find very many. There were no complete Greek manuscripts of the New Testament in this monastery. There was only just a few fragments. So he had to take all these fragments and sort of piece them together. And even when he pieced them together, there were spots missing, things missing out of them. In his book, The Text of the New Testament, Bruce Metzger writes this. This is his account of Erasmus's work. Since Erasmus could not find a manuscript which contained the entire Greek Testament, he utilized several for various parts of the New Testament. For most of the text, he relied on two rather inferior manuscripts from a monastic library at Basel, one of the Gospels and one of the Acts and Epistles, both dating from about the 12th century. Erasmus compared them with two or three others of the same books and entered occasional corrections for the printer in the margins or between the lines of the Greek script. For the book of Revelation, he had but one manuscript dating from the 12th century, which he had borrowed from his friend Reuchlin, which I think I said that incorrectly in the teenage class this morning, so if they hear that, I told them wrong. Unfortunately, this manuscript lacked the final leaf, which had contained the last six verses of the book. So he has one manuscript of Revelation, and it's missing the last six verses of the book. That's what he's saying. For these verses, as well as a few other passages throughout the book where the Greek text of the Apocalypse and the adjoining Greek commentary with which the manuscript was supplied are so mixed up as to be indistinguishable, Erasmus depended upon the Latin Vulgate translating this text into Greek. All right, so what's he saying? Well, basically, Erasmus didn't have a complete copy of the book of Revelation. He didn't have the last six verses, and there were other things missing within that book. So rather than consulting, trying to find another Greek manuscript, he instead went to the Latin Vulgate, translated that into Greek, and that was the Greek manuscript he came up with for Revelation. This, he was the second one to publish a Greek manuscript, and the reason we mention this is because Erasmus forms the foundation for the Textus Receptus. There's a few things to note about this translation. First of all, I shouldn't say translation, but this copy. First of all, he was working with several different manuscripts, none of which were complete, and none of which dated from before the 12th century. Now, you know, age does factor into these things. It's not an absolute deal breaker, so to speak, but they were from the 12th century, and they were fragments. He also was substituting in things in the Latin Vulgate where he couldn't complete the Greek manuscript, which if the Latin Vulgate is translated correctly, is no big deal, right? If it's translated correctly, it shouldn't be any big deal. He had at least six verses missing in Revelation, and it appears, based on Metzger's quotation, that there were some other spots where he had to fit things in. So we're not talking about a thorough work. It was a work done in haste. It was done very quickly. It was done with the intent of being the first one published, and he lost the race and was the second one published. But Erasmus released four subsequent editions, and the two most important are the fourth and the fifth editions. Now, at this point, we didn't have, or at least there weren't a lot of Greek manuscripts around. So we're working in a very different time period than we are today. We're very much accustomed. I mean, Duane talked about hopping on the computer and looking at a Greek manuscript. You know, we have accessibility today that people centuries ago just could only dream of. I mean, we can look at multiple Greek manuscripts. We have all these advantages. But in the time that Erasmus was doing this work, there was not a lot out there. A lot of stuff was like that story about the Codex Sinaiticus. It was just stuffed in some monastery someplace, and there were people there that really didn't care about it. So this was the condition in the 16th century. Erasmus released four more editions and made a few corrections along the way and made one edition, the seventh verse of the fifth chapter of 1 John, and we may get into that a little bit later because I think that's a significant deal. But I want to continue on with this Textus Receptus. Following Erasmus was a guy by the name of Stephanus. And he was heavily influenced by the fourth and fifth editions of Erasmus's text. He used this as his basis. He also included several additional manuscripts. As time goes on, they were including more and more manuscripts, but nothing like what we have today. Nothing like what we have today. I mean, we're talking in the third edition of Stephanus' Greek New Testament, he had 15 manuscripts to work from, so not a lot total, okay? The most important edition of his was the third edition, the third edition, And this became the dominant text, the dominant Greek text in England, beginning about 1550. I think you can see where this is going here. All right. The next significant scholar was a man by the name of Beza, B-E-Z-A. He was actually a student of John Calvin. He produced 10 editions, 9 during his lifetime, 1 posthumously. I guess he really didn't do it, but it was published posthumously. All right. His edition of 1588 and 1589 were the most important, and they strongly influenced the King James Version. Now, just so we understand what's going on here, Erasmus began this, Stephanus built on it, and Beza built further on that work. So these manuscripts are being influenced by one another. There's a great deal of similarity between them. There are changes as they go along, but by and large, they are essentially the same down through the years. The final two brothers, the final contributors are two brothers, the Elzevirs. They were European, and they published a version of the Greek Old Testament, Greek New Testament. When was that? I don't have a year on that. It was their second edition. And it, like all of these, was they're interrelated. And in their preface to the second edition, they write this: Textum ergo habis nunc ab omnibus receptum. In quo nihil immatutum aut corruptum damus. You have the text which is now received by all, in which we give nothing changed or corrupted. The text received by all, or the textus receptus. The text received by all. Textus receptus means the received text. The received text. The text received by all. And that just sort of became the name for this group of manuscripts. I shouldn't say manuscripts, but this group of versions of the Greek New Testament that all built upon one another. That's how we came to this name, the Textus Receptus. The criticism that is leveled against the Textus Receptus goes back to what I mentioned earlier about Erasmus. It's not taking into account as many Greek manuscripts as we have available to us today. Much of it was done without a good knowledge of ancient Greek, that we've discovered secular examples of Koine Greek today, helping us understand how these words were used back then, which enables translators to make better translations in our vernacular today than they could back then. Now, I'm not trying to incite any sort of debate as to which is better, King James or anything else. That's not my intention here. The King James Version and the Textus Receptus, I believe, is a perfectly acceptable translation, and I think it's a perfectly acceptable source to be translating from. But there is another approach. But I'm going to pause before we go on. Are there any questions or comments? This is what that whole debate is about, essentially. Really, there's two schools of thought at work here. John Woody's got something up here.
Excuse me. Where does Tyndale figure in this?
I believe Tyndale's translation
is from the
I think he did use the Latin Vulgate, but I think he also incorporated either Erasmus's edition or Stephanus's edition. I can't remember which it is.
No, his New Testament was 1526.
1526.
Erasmus was available, at least in some versions.
Oh, you've got it right in front of you, don't you? Oh, excellent. Very good. Thank you. I'll let Kathy. I'll let Kathy answer the question. Uh huh. Go ahead. I don't have that in my notes, so I'm glad.
I have a table here, and great. It shows it's a family tree of the New Testament, and it shows Tyndale in 1526, and it's from the family tree of the Latin Vulgate, which is
interesting.
400, and Erasmus is 1516.
Yeah, that's
and
right.
And Erasmus is coming from the Greek.
Yes.
So
okay.
Tyndale is, it, but then the King James mm-hmm. uses both Tyndale and yes. Erasmus. So there mm-hmm. is some combining there. It's not totally just yeah. what Erasmus did.
Yeah, it's not a complete... Well, Erasmus used the Latin Vulgate too, so...
Right,
you know,
but
so,
he
yeah.
did try to use mostly Greek.
Yeah, mostly Greek, yeah.
Yeah,
yeah. Yeah, I didn't prepare to talk about the translation of the King James, but yeah, I'm glad you had that because I... That's one of those things that I read, but I couldn't remember. John has a follow-up, I think. John's got a follow-up.
The reason I brought that up is because I understood that the writers of the King James translation the word Passover has been translated Passover in all the Bible except it was mentioned as Easter.
Yes.
Use the Tyndale reference.
Yeah, well, there's all kinds of things like that that have crept in, aren't there? Like we talked about baptism the other day. Why can't anybody just translate it immersion? You know, it's just somebody be brave, please be brave. Translate it. Don't transliterate it any longer. You know, it's just things like that. No translation, no translator is inspired. When it's accurately translated, it would help us a great deal. So, yes, Keith.
You mentioned regarding Erasmus
yes.
that none of the manuscripts he used were earlier than the 12th century.
Yes. I believe that's correct, yeah.
As others then had other manuscripts, are we implying that those were earlier or the same or later transcripts?
Well, that's the second half of this, which is the two schools of thought here. We've got the Textus Receptus school, so to speak. We've got the critical approach, which is going to, I think, answer your question. Yeah. Any other questions? All right, let's see if we can at least get through this. Are you moving somewhere?
No.
Okay, good. All right. Okay. All right. The other side of the coin, so to speak, is what we might call the critical approach. And this isn't critical in the sense of being critical, criticizing someone, not in that sense, but rather the idea of textual criticism. I've also seen this called the majority as well. It's this idea of taking... all that we have as far as the New Testament manuscripts are concerned, taking them all into account, comparing and contrasting, and seeing if we can get to the bottom of what the original actually was. Where it differs from the Textus Receptus is, well, because it takes into account older manuscripts, and it also tries to broaden itself out by accepting a lot of manuscripts in determining the text of the New Testament. Wow, 3 o'clock. Okay. The primary sources that the critical approach uses are the three major... Make sure I get this right. Yeah. Three major manuscripts, which are the Codex Sinaiticus, which we've already mentioned, the Codex Vaticanus, I think that's right, make sure I spelled that correctly, Vaticanus, yes, and the Codex Alexandrinus. These are the three oldest Greek manuscripts that are nearly complete, and they also, some of them also include the Old Testament. The Codex Vaticanus, for instance, contains the Old Testament. For instance, the Codex Vaticanus begins with Genesis chapter 46, verse 28. It goes through almost the entire Bible. It's got a few Psalms missing. I'm trying to read my notes here. You know, when you write these things at 5:30 in the morning, sometimes they don't always make sense. Hebrews 9:14. Okay. Excuse me, I misstated this earlier. It begins with Genesis 46:28, and it ends with Hebrews 9:14. So everything after Hebrews 9:14 is not present. I think I've got that correct. For some reason, that's just not making any sense to me as I'm reading it right now. Okay. So it's nearly complete copy of the Bible. We've already talked about the Codex Sinaiticus. It's not the entire manuscript, but it's most of the New Testament. And Tischendorf actually was followed up by some others who discovered some more leaves, I think rather recently, if memory serves me correct, within the last half century. The Codex Alexandrinus, of course, comes from Alexandria. It contains virtually the entire Old and New Testaments. There are a few things missing from the Alexandrian. The Vaticanus dates from 4th century. I don't have an exact date because I don't think I could find an exact date on the Vaticanus. We've already mentioned the Sinaiticus, and the Alexandrian dates from the 5th century. So we have a couple 4th century manuscripts and a 5th century. And these are the basis for the critical approach. They take all these into account. These were not available to Erasmus when he did his version of the Greek New Testament back in the 16th century. In fact, the Codex Vaticanus wasn't available until the late 19th century. The Catholic Church apparently didn't want anybody to get access to it for a long time. One of the things that began to be noticed as more and more Greek manuscripts came out was that the Latin Vulgate's translation of the New Testament was actually quite poor. And there were some real problems with it. And as more and more Greek manuscripts came out, the more that became apparent, and they weren't very happy about that. That was the official Bible of the Roman Catholic Church. Anything else about these three? I'm kind of just blowing through these notes here, I know. We also have in this those papyri that we mentioned. Those papyri fragments, they're also taken into account with this. Okay. And these are really the prime sources for a person who takes the critical approach, which is trying to get everything together, compare and contrast, and see in the process of doing so if we can identify what that original revealed Word of God was. The way they do this is kind of interesting, actually. As they compare these ancient Greek manuscripts, they begin to notice that these manuscripts are essentially regional in their transmission. They come up with what are called text types, Alexandrian, Syrian, it's also called Byzantine. And Western, by which they mean Western Europe. What they do is they take this manuscript, and they look through it, and they see, does it have some of the characteristics that fit into one of these text types? All right? So they begin to group these manuscripts together by text types, and within those text types, they begin to look for agreement across those text types, see if they can arrive at some sort of consensus concerning a verse or a passage. Once they've arrived at that, then they compare among the text types to see if there are any, if there's agreement among those text types. And that's essentially how they come up with their conclusion, I guess you might say. All right, are there any questions? I don't know if I'm leaving a lot of questions out there. I'm trying to pick and choose what I think are the important things in all this. Yeah, Dwayne?
I think it's important to that when they found more manuscripts that they didn't agree with each other.
Exactly right. Yeah. There's a ton of variation in these manuscripts. I think the last time, the last number I saw was something like 200,000 total variations in New Testament manuscripts. But when you think about it, when you're dealing with 26,000 manuscripts, there's going to be variation. That's a lot of manuscripts, a lot of manuscripts. And what we're talking about is the same thing we saw with the Old Testament. Primarily slips the pen, changes in spelling, changes in grammar and word order. Let me give you just an example or two here. One example I've got in my notes. Where is it? For instance, Matthew 1:18. Here are four different ways it's given in various manuscripts. Is it the birth of Jesus Christ or the birth of Christ Jesus? Other manuscripts have the birth of Jesus, while others read the birth of Christ. That's four variations, and each one of those counts for one. But does that change the essence of the message? No, it doesn't. So word order changes, grammar changes, spelling changes that evolve down through the years. But what's not lost is the meaning of the passage, and that's the most important thing. So those are the types of variations we're talking about. Nothing that really affects the integrity of the text, so to speak. Does that speak to your point there? Yeah. Anything else? All right. Oh, Mike.
Just an observation. Mm-hmm. When we look at our English translations, and we seem to have had quite a bit of discussion these last 2 weeks about some of the variations in English translations. And we seem to be focusing on all the differences and the nuances between those differences. But the amazing thing is the similarity.
Yeah.
Even in the difference that you're talking about in these Greek sources, there's just a tremendous amount of similarity, and certainly the central message
absolutely
is consistently the same.
Thank you. And that's an important fact to remember, is that there is an amazing amount of consistency. And the way these variations are numbered, I mean, they add up really quickly. If you've got 4,000 of the same variation in the same word, it's going to count 4,000 times. So these numbers add up extremely quickly when you're working with 26,000 manuscripts. But Mike is exactly right. When we look at the overwhelming majority, there's no variation, particularly in the meaning of the passage. Thank you. Anything else? All right, we've got 5 minutes. The other things that a person who uses the critical approach will incorporate are translations into other languages, ancient translations, that is. And there are three major groups here. We have the Syriac, the Coptic, and the Latin. These are ancient translations of the New Testament. So as the word of God went out, as the gospel was preached, as these letters began to circulate into various regions, they were translated, sometimes not very well. They were done by locals, but yet they were translated. Syriac, of course, refers to the Syrian area just north of Palestine. It's very close to Aramaic. I think Byzantine is another word that's used for that as well. The Coptic comes from Egypt. There are two different Coptic dialects that we could talk about, but we don't have time. and the Latin. All these figure into helping us determine what is the original language of the New Testament. Finally, a critical approach would incorporate the use of those quotations by the Anti-Nicene writers. I don't think they lend a whole lot of credence to this, but I can't speak authoritatively on this. Just taking into account what they, how they were phrasing various things from various New Testament passages. By and large, if you're not holding a King James or a New King James in your hand right now, you're going to have a version that's going to take the critical approach for the most part. New American Standard, NIV, English Standard. Well, I don't know. The English Standard Version, yeah, it's going to take that more into account. Excuse me? Yeah, English Standard's going to take more of the critical approach as well. I think the American Standard Version of 1901 that Keith's been reading, it incorporated more than just the Textus Receptus. Yeah. Yeah, it started working things in. Now, if you do use the King James and the New King James, what you'll notice, at least in my New King James, is you often have these little footnotes down here that tell you what other manuscripts say. And this will be my closing comment on this whole subject today, and that is this. No translation, no copy, no translator or no copyist is inspired, and we have all these materials available to us. It's my belief that we should pick a translation that is conservative, that seeks to communicate, to translate the Word of God as accurately as possible, but not to just use one in our study. I believe very strongly in bringing in these other conservative translations and using those and helping understand the passage. And as Mike rightly points out, in most cases, they agree. They agree. In most cases. I'm going to stop here. We've got 3 minutes. I'm going to open it up for questions. Dave Evans has a question back here.
I don't have a question. It's just a comment.
Oh,
thank
you.
The Iliad by Homer,
yeah,
was the most prized Greek document that ever existed.
Yes.
And it has many, many more variations and problems than the New Testament does. So
thank you.
You take the prized Greek document and you look at 400 copies and there's thousands of variations as well.
Yes, thank you for that. Thank you. Anything else as we close for today? Oh, I did say I was going to say something about 1 John 5:7, didn't I? Milford.
I think I've heard some of the old evangelists say through the years that all these translations, if you're looking on how to seek salvation, it's in there.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And that's one of the major points, is that as far as doctrine goes, as far as salvational matters are concerned, these variations don't affect those things at all. The things that are truly essential for our salvation, there's no dispute about these things whatsoever. Thank you for that. A good reminder. Anybody else? We've got 60 seconds. Well, I'm going to conclude early then. And Dwayne, if you want to talk about 1 John 5:7, I'd be happy to talk about it. Or anybody else wants to know what's up with 1 John 5:7, I'd be happy to talk. Thank you very much.